Wistful Thinking is brought to you by the Cage Club Podcast Network. For more podcasts about movies and nostalgia, visit cageclub.me. That's cageclub.me.
Welcome to Wistful Thinking, the podcast where we revisit pop culture from our youth to see if it's as good all grown up. And that's not our real intro anymore, but I'm going to keep saying it forever. I'm Jordan Pullen Clark. With me is my co-host, Carrigale O'Regan.
Hello.
And welcome to Surrealist February.
Ooh. I don't know why I thought that was the appropriate noise, but that's what came out.
It's a little spooky sometimes.
Yeah, but I feel like maybe it should have been more of a like honking noise and like a...
I think any of them would have been appropriate, but I think even more appropriate is to everyone go ahead and do this exercise, visualize what that noise looked like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, give it
which
texture.
Is what I'm doing constantly at all moments is thinking about what ooh looks
yeah.
like.
What color is it? How big is it? What direction does it travel in? I feel like that's more valuable exercise even than making a noise. Mm. Okay, so we were talking about what to do next a few weeks ago, and I was like browsing through movies on Hulu looking for ideas, and a Luis Buñuel movie came up. And for one semester in 2006, I'm going to say it was, I went to NYU for cinema studies. And I took four classes while I was there, and one of them was a comparative directors class on Luis Buñuel and Fritz Lang.
Because oh, interesting.
They have kind of similar stories on paper in that they were both European-born and then made many films outside of where they were born. Fritz Lang was able to find like quite a lot of success in America, and Luis Buñuel never did, but did find success in Mexico. And well,
France.
Success isn't the best word for what he found there. he made money there.
Mm-hmm.
But then had like a resurgence at the end of his career where he was very successful making films in Europe again, but like to international acclaim. It was a class comparing the two, and I just fell in love with Luis Buñuel because for the same reasons I fell in love with David Lynch, but I think that Luis Buñuel is a lot funnier.
Mm. Yeah.
He's cheeky.
I can see that.
So if you're not familiar with Kara, had you seen any of his movies before this?
So the only one that I had seen many times because I went to art school. And
right.
If you're going to see a Luis Buñuel film in art school, it's probably going to be Un Chien Andalou, which is exactly what it was. I think I watched it in three or four different classes.
Like that's
but
the
I had
one
never
yeah.
yeah, but I had never seen any of the other ones. So this was really fun and exciting for me to explore his work, which then, you know, like opened up a door back to Salvador Dali, who of course I did study because I had always approached surrealism from a fine art perspective and not as much looking at the film or literature ends of it. So this has been an interesting experiment for me to Ooh. Go back and learn about.
I can't wait to hear more about it. I'm going to first talk before that, though. I will talk about the... Kara watched three movies. I watched two.
Three movies and a scene from another one.
What scene did you... Oh, did you watch the toilet scene?
Yes,
oh,
which
I'm so
loved
glad.
So
it's perfect.
Much.
It's the best scene of any
it's so
movie
funny.
Ever.
Yeah.
So... But I've seen everything that she watched. I just didn't do as good a job refreshing on all of it. So she'll have to help me through one of them in particular. But so we watched, as she mentioned, Un Chien Andalou, which is from 1929. Yeah.
That sounds right.
so it's a film that Buñuel and Dali co-wrote and made together. And the way that they, well, so, and the way that they got the idea is that they were hanging out, they were friends.
Well, so this is, I don't think I realized this, but they were like art school bros.
Yeah, they were.
Which, hilarious. Just thinking, and them and one other guy whose name I don't remember, but like also made stuff. And just like thinking about them, just like hanging out and being like, yo, bro, wouldn't it be so cool if like we did this thing?
Yeah, and, because Buñuel didn't start out like intending to be a filmmaker. He just like, I forget what movie it was. He like saw some movie ones and got super obsessed with it and was like, oh, well, this is what I want to do. And so they were hanging out one day and they were like, Dolly was like, I had this weird dream where the moon turned into an eyeball and it got sliced in half. And then Buñuel was like, huh, yeah, I had this weird dream where like ants were coming out of this guy's hand. And they were like, well, that's a movie.
Oh, and that's so interesting because the ants on the hand is such a Dolly image to me. It's interesting
that
it came from.
I'll make sure that I'm right. I think those are who the dreams belonged to, but I will check.
Oh, I mean, I'm not saying that it's not.
No, I might have totally mixed them up because you're right.
Well, yeah, because ants and like cracks and holes and things are a repeated motif in many Dalí's paintings, and I think like some of his other multimedia work as well.
You're right. Buñuel had the moon dream, and Dalí had the ants dream.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way that they made it, they wrote it like in a very short amount of time and they sat together and like the rule was that like basically it was only allowed to be nonsense. Like it was only allowed to be like dream stuff. They were not allowed to like try to explain any of it. They didn't try to explain any of it. And so one of them would look at the other one and be like, what about this? And if they were both like, yes, they did it.
Is this anything?
And if one of them was like, no, they didn't do it. That's how everything in this got made. And it's very Lynchian in that they're basically like, no, don't try to look for the meaning. Like, that's not the point.
Yeah. Is it Lynchian or is it
Lynch's
Buñuelian?
It's Buñuelian. Well, questionable, because I would argue that most of his other films are very purposeful. This is like very abstract. Him and Dalí made one other short film together that's actually much longer. It's almost an hour long, or maybe it is an hour long. That is also very abstract. And then everything else he made does have some kind of narrative and generally some kind of purpose that you can read into and assume that he had some kind of thoughts and was making a point when he made it.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I think it would be a good idea for us to talk about the origins of surrealism and what surrealism is. Before we go any further.
Cool. I think you'll do better at that than me. Do you want to do it?
Yeah, I'm going to pull up the Wikipedia article.
I just read it also, but like you went to more art school than I did, so I feel like you'll do a better job.
Yeah. Well, so surrealism really was a movement that started around 1917. It was really kind of a reaction to the truly nonsensical nature of World War One, and just like the havoc that it wreaked. But I would also say add to that also the Spanish flu, which a lot of people don't talk about in this time frame, but actually killed like 3-5% of the world's population. So in addition to this like massive mortality that was happening with the war, also there was this massive mortality killing like way more people than World War One like and World War Two I think put together. So just like if you can kind of like put your brain or attempt to, I don't know if we really can put your brain in a world where that kind of thing is happening, like nothing makes sense and everything is horrifying and it just kind of all seems like a nightmare. So that was really kind of the catalyst for that movement in particular. But prior to World War One, there was a movement called Dadaism, which was really, and this is where I have to lean on some definitions because it's hard to explain, but Dadaism was an art movement of the European avant-garde in the early 20th century that started kind of in Switzerland and France. And I guess, was it also a reaction to World War One? I don't know. I thought it predated it, but now that I'm looking at this Wikipedia article, I might be wrong, or the Wikipedia article might be wrong, so who knows. Anyway, Dadaism was like kind of an anti-art movement that like cut up like all of the ideas about like what art was and aestheticism and like modern capitalist society and kind of turned it on its head. The most famous of the Dadaists being, what's his name? Marcel Duchamp. And the piece of his that most people who didn't go to art school might know is The Toilet. He just like took a urinal and turned it upside down and was like, this is art. And everyone was like, what? And that's Dadaism. So that was the precursor to Surrealism, which relied really heavily on the subconscious and dream states. It was also very heavily influenced by the movements in psychology by Freud and Jung and like all of that sort of like stuff that's going on in the back of your brain. Am I making any sense?
I mean, to me you are, yeah.
Yes? Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't really like plan this out before I started talking, so I'm not even sure where I am. But the Surrealists were actually like this kind of formalized group in France, led by André Breton, and they, you know, they fancied themselves kind of intellectuals and revolutionaries and et cetera, et cetera. They sound like a real nightmare group of dudes.
Yeah,
like
they
not
really,
fun to
I
be around.
They really do. Like the like when I read about all these men, I'm like, God, this is one of my favorite parts from Buñuel's Wikipedia. Is hold on, he dated this woman for 5 years, and then, gosh, I want to find the exact quote. She basically was like, and then I broke up with him because he was completely insufferable and horrible to be around. Like, I'm sure they were all like that.
Yeah. Well, Buñuel was actually like, I forget if it was Buñuel or Dali, now that I'm thinking about it. One of them was like excommunicated from the group because of like they didn't, you know, play by the rules. And it just, it's so funny to me that like this group of, I don't know, people who are like trying to do some sort of like anti-art thing because art takes itself too seriously would then also take themselves so seriously.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this was why I hated art school, because everyone takes themselves too seriously.
Can I go on a detour for a second? This is,
sure.
This is one of my favorite things that I remember about this class, is that, like, yes, like we were watching these, like, you know, nonsense films, and, like, I was not, like, I'm not an intellectual, I'm not an academic, like, I felt very out of place, like, in that program, and so one time we watched one of his films. I kind of think it was like one of his Mexican melodramas, which was like a lot of them were like very straightforward, except he would still like find these ways to like sneak himself into them, you know? And
how Lynchian.
So but it not in a Lynch, like in very subtle ways. Because they were like money makers, you know, like people went to see them. They weren't art films.
Right.
But in one of them, there's just a shot of a raw piece of meat. And I'm sitting in this class and we're talking about what is the meat. And at some point, somebody raised their hand and answered the question and they said, what if the meat is just meat? And I was like, thank you. Like, I was just like so appreciative of like a voice not
like, you guys, maybe it's not that
yeah,
deep.
Yeah, like a person who was just like not trying to read too deep into every little detail, because I personally found that incredibly stressful in this like
too.
Very academic world of like smart people.
Yeah.
That's like one of the biggest things I remember from that class is just being like, oh, it's okay to just think about it like that sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wouldn't necessarily say I find it stressful. I just find it deeply exhausting.
Yeah.
One of the classes that I wound up seeing this and like a couple other surrealist films, like Cocteau's Orpheus and I'm like forgetting the other couple, but we watched it in a class that I took called Existentialist Paris, which, oh boy, was a real snoozer. But like that was another thing that was kind of like going on during this time. Intellectual circles in Paris that was really like the epicenter of the surrealist movement during the 20s and 30s. But yeah, no, I just remember sitting through that entire class just being like, why? Who cares? We're all gonna die. Who cares?
Well, yeah,
I mean, it always comes back to that for me.
It's fun and interesting to analyze shit. But yeah, mm-hmm. at a certain point, like, who cares?
Yeah.
Okay, is that, do you want
well,
to say
that's
more
the
things?
Episode.
We could stop it right there. Who cares? Do you want to say more things about surrealism?
Not right now, but they might come up as we talk.
Okay. So that was one movie we watched, which is, I think, his most famous film by far.
Yes.
Like, I think art school students far and wide in many different disciplines are made to watch this film.
Mm-hmm.
It's on YouTube if you're listening and you want to watch it. It's on YouTube in its entirety.
The version that I watched, so the title cards are in French, but the version that I watched had Spanish subtitles.
Same.
So
I
was like, I don't
one.
Know what's going on.
I looked up what they all said.
I did too, and then I was like, oh, okay, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter, but it does. I appreciated the, like, feeling, because they were all cards indicating how much time had passed, or, mm-hmm. like, some of them were how much time has passed. One of them was, like, 8 years later. One of them was, like, 15 years earlier. One of them just says spring. Like, they're meant to place you in time, and also it's not like it makes sense anyway.
Yes.
Both Dali and Buñuel appear in that film.
And I didn't recognize either of them.
I recognized Buñuel, but had to go back and be like, yeah, I guess that's Dali.
Yeah, well, I think because, like, our image of him is as a much older artist, and like he had like a like the images that we're familiar with of Dali with like the wacky twisted mustache,
yeah.
and everything, that was like he had figured that out a little bit later, and it's like, because this was a very,
very
early
young.
Work for both of them. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so the next movie we watched is called The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie, which is a 1972 film that Buñuel made in France,
It's in French.
Yeah, it's a little bit in Spanish, but yeah, okay, we're going to say he made it in France. And he made it, like, in his kind of resurgence. Like, there was a period where he was like, yep, nope, that's my last movie, I'm done now. And then he made, like, three more movies after that, and they were some
What are
of
you,
his...
Steven Soderbergh?
But like, those films are, like, definitely some of the more memorable ones.
Yeah. Well, also, it's the last stuff that he made. Like, so I always find this so interesting about art and stuff is that, like, we remember what is most recent and not necessarily what is best or most poignant, I think. I mean, even for surrealism, the surrealists that we think of as surrealists, like, that are, you know, banner icons of the movement are people who are working later. People like Dali and Buñuel and Frida Kahlo and, you know, like, these are kind of like the last vestiges of the movement and not necessarily really pivotal I mean, obviously very influential, but not necessarily for that specific movement, and instead for subsequent movements. And I think a lot of times with artists individually for their body of work, that is also true.
I actually take that back, because now I'm thinking about all of his films, and my favorite my favorite one actually falls in the middle. It's a movie about, actually my two favorite ones fall in the middle-ish. The best one is a movie called The Exterminating Angel, which is a movie about a bunch of rich people who go to a dinner party, and then when the party's over and they all try to leave, they just can't leave, and there's no explanation why. And so, like,
which is basically the plot to every one of his movies.
Well, before, when I was like, no, you actually can read into a lot of the things he does, it's because so many of his themes recur over and over.
Taken together, they mean a lot, but like individually, I think it's harder to read into.
No, in his, it's pretty easy. Like, they're like, not that he beats you over the head with it, but it's just like, he's cheeky. They're right there. Like, he wants you to see them, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that one's pretty awesome. But so anyway, okay. Discreet Charm, 1972. It won the Oscar for best foreign film in 1973, and he refused to come to the ceremony because he was like, I don't care about that. So his producer accepted the award, but then they asked him to please take a picture with his Oscar, so he did, but he put on like a wig and like silly glasses, so that he just like was clearly like such a joke to him.
Yeah, I'm looking up the picture now.
So this movie is about a group of sick. You look at the picture.
Yeah.
This
reminds me that Bong Joon-ho recently in an interview was like, I don't really care about the Oscars. I mean, they're really a local film festival.
Yeah.
Which is like such a sick burn and so good. That's but pretty anyway, great. Continue.
So this movie is about six wealthy people who for the entire film are trying to get together to eat food, and they never do. They're constantly interrupted by ridiculous and hilarious things. I actually really like the way that Roger Ebert described it, so I'm going to read it. He says, the joke in The Discreet Charm is the way that Buñuel interrupts the meals with the secrets that lurk beneath the surface of his decaying European aristocracy. Witlessness, adultery, drug dealing, cheating, military coups, pervasion, and the paralysis of boredom. His central characters are politicians, the military, and the rich, but in a generous mood, he throws in a supporting character to make fun of the church, a bishop whose fetish is to dress up as a gardener and work as a servant in the gardens of the wealthy. So yeah, that was like a short list of things that they are interrupted by. It doesn't include the time that they're interrupted by a dead body in the restaurant. And there are also just a lot of scheduling kerfuffles where they're like, no, we said this time. And they're like, there's no way we said this time. And they just argue about it for a while. Yeah. Kara, what were your impressions of this movie? You had not seen it before. I'd seen it a lot of times.
No, I just had fun. I really liked it. I loved the gardener priest.
Yeah, he's pretty funny.
I was like, yeah, I would do that too. I would be like, can I just work in your garden?
He has one of the best scenes in the movie that, like, so the thing that most of Buñuel's films do is they go off on, like, tangents that you're like, wait, what? Like, yes, there are main characters, but then for like a whole portion of the movie, it will just follow somebody else and then like boop on back to the people you used to be
hanging out.
And
it has no bearing on like the larger story.
No, not at all. I think the priest has one of the best one of those where there's like a woman.
He goes to give somebody their last rites, somebody who's on their deathbed.
And will you tell it?
Okay. Well, earlier he had explained, I guess, to the mistress of the house that his parents had died when he was very young and that their gardener had murdered them.
I don't think he says that. Does he say it?
No, he definitely does.
Oh, okay.
Well, I don't know if he says, like, and the gardener murdered them. He might have, like,
I think
said
it was
more artfully
than
that.
It's a little bit of a reveal when this scene happens, but okay, keep going.
Yeah. But anyway, so he goes to give this guy his last rites, and the guy makes his deathbed confession that he worked as a gardener and killed his bosses, and it turns out that that was the parents of this priest, and then the priest murders the guy.
Yeah.
I don't know why I'm laughing.
He, like, no, but it is funny. Like, he pretends like he's not gonna murder him, too. He's like, oh, I forgive you. Like, it's okay. Like, bye. And then he's walking out of the room, and he picks up a gun and, like, slowly loads it and just shoots him.
Yeah.
It's well-paced.
It is.
And well. This happens in, like, If Buñuel can find a way to be like, fuck religion, he will do it. It's a very recurring theme in his films, less so in this one, but obviously is still there.
Contextually is important to understand, the incredibly huge and oppressive role that the Catholic Church played in Spain at this time, and pretty much always, but when he was growing up was like a very regressive and oppressive time where the Catholic Church really kind of ruled over everything, and that is a great recipe to make an angry artist who wants to say fuck the church at all possible opportunities.
His best, I've can't remember and haven't seen all of his movies, but the one that I think is his best fuck the church movie is one called Simon of the Desert, which is short. You should watch it. I'm sure it's on YouTube. It's a movie. I think Simon was probably a real dude or based on a real dude, but I don't know anything about Christian religions, or almost nothing. But it's this dude who lives in this like small town, and he's doing some kind of like hunger strike, and like he's standing atop this pedestal, and like a part of the joke of the movie is he like super likes the attention that he gets from standing, even though that's like not supposed to be part of it.
It's always part of it though.
But he starts to get tortured by like somebody's like taunting him, and it turns out in the end it's the devil, and it's a lady, and she dances naked at the end, and it's pretty great. I like that one. Okay, Discreet Charm. The thing that I could think about most while I was watching this time, but I was like, Kara must be obsessed with all of their outfits, the women's outfits.
Yeah, they are good.
Like really good, like 70s. Mm-hmm. French, like well put together ladies. My favorite, the first time I laughed out loud is where they go to this restaurant. It's the second time they're trying to eat together. The first is like a messed up scheduling thing, so they're like, well, okay, but I know this restaurant, it's really close to here, let's just go to the restaurant. They're like, okay, so they drive to the restaurant, it's locked, and then the staff opens the door, and they're like, are you sure you're open? And they're like, yeah, no, it's fine, come in. And they go in, and it's completely empty, and they find out that that's because the owner has died that day. And they have his body just, like, laying in the kitchen, and they're all, like, surrounding him, and they loved him so much and whatever. And one of the women goes, he died with that suit on? Because he's, like, all dressed up. And I just thought that that was so funny. It's like she's almost pointing out that she knows she's in a movie. Like, I don't know. I love it. I laughed. You go.
I actually... I watched this many weeks ago, it feels like, at this point, because we were going to do this episode sooner than now, but my body turned into a hot bag of soup. It was a whole thing. I had a near-death experience, and we had to postpone this episode, so it's been a while since I watched
it was
it
like
and a lot has
two
happened.
Weeks ago, yeah. And it's, yeah. It's not a particularly easy movie to remember to begin with, because it's...
Yeah,
because
it doesn't have a real narrative structure or anything like that.
I mean, it does a little bit at the beginning, and then, like, really falls apart.
Yeah.
It does... So... it all starts to feel very surreal, but you're like, okay, I'm still here for this. Like, this is all still a thing that we're supposed to believe is kind of really happening. And then there's a scene where they all are sitting down at another dinner table, and a servant comes out with like a chicken, like a on a platter. But it doesn't, it looks kind of plasticky, but you're like, okay, whatever, I don't know, maybe this is the time they're going to eat, here we go. And he drops it on the floor, and you realize it's just a prop chicken. And you find that they are on a theater stage, and it's like a play that they don't know that they're in. And then from there on out, it's just like a series of essentially people waking up from either being in their own dream or in somebody else's dream, and you're like, okay, what is this? Where are we? Is any of this real? And it doesn't matter.
Yeah, it's all just a dream within a dream within a nightmare within a who cares.
Pretty much, yeah. But in a fun way, not in like a, yeah. It's not like, it's, it sounds lazy to say they used like a, oh, that was all a dream, but it, that's not how it feels at all.
No, it's definitely layered enough, and like, it's intricate is how I would describe the kind of like dreamscape in this movie, that like you never know what is the dream, and maybe it's all a dream, but why are they all walking on a road? And I don't know. It was fun. I liked it a lot.
And similarly to Un Chien Andalou, the some of the kind of like very non sequitur things in this are just based on real dreams that like Buñuel had had, like the one about the cousin, the dead cousin. He like meets the guy. Oh, when does that one even happen? It's like close to the end. And then there's the other one. There's another one about the guy with his dead mom. Like,
and I've definitely had nightmares about being on a stage in a production that I didn't know was happening.
Yeah. That's probably a pretty common one.
Yeah, I'm stressed out just thinking about it.
My favorite character is Florence, the alcoholic sister, because I feel like she's the only one who's like kind of admitting the shitty reality they live in. And she's just like, well, I'll get drunk. Who cares? Like, this is all a joke anyway. Like, I feel like she's actually maybe the smartest one, even though she's treated like the dumbest one.
Yeah.
So I appreciate her. Okay, anything else that you want to say about this movie?
I don't think so. I didn't take any notes because I was like, what would I even write down?
It's definitely a difficult one to talk about, especially, I think it's also a difficult one to talk about as a standalone movie.
Mm-hmm.
But you can.
Well, yeah, because it has, like, because it doesn't really have any actual meaning to it. So, like again, on its own, it doesn't really mean anything. But, like, taken as part of a body of work, there's more sense to it. And it makes it easier to talk about, like, in the context of his other work than just alone as, like, a movie.
Yeah, and I do think it is something that, like, yeah, we can sit here and be like, well, you know, he did this because he hates this structure and he hates, you know, and he's trying to fight against whatever. And we can say all that, but it is so, film is a visual medium, and this truly is something that, like, if you want to understand what he was doing and how he was doing, like, just watch it. It is actually, like, kind of challenging to talk about it.
Yeah. And challenging to watch, too, because it doesn't work the way that we're trained to expect movies to work.
There's no music in it.
Oh, I didn't even notice.
No music, and did you notice there was two, I think there's two, there might have been three times in the movie where the sound is purposefully blocked out by an airplane noise?
Oh, huh. I might have noticed it at the time, but it did not stick with me.
It's funny. You should go back and find those parts. I don't know if this is real or not, but Buñuel has said that, like, he did all the sound in this movie, and everyone is like, yeah, and he was very old and almost deaf at the time. But there are these like few very well placed sounds that make no sense. Like they're not outside. You don't see an airplane. It's just that it's just this noise pollution for a brief amount of time. So that's I that's different, and definitely watching a movie without music, the like when I think of what this movie sounds like, all I hear are their footsteps, like the sounds of their shoes, like walking through like through that nothingness that like repeats over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
That's the music of this film. Okay, so then the other one that Kara watched that I've not seen in a long time was a movie called Land Without Bread. It has a real has a Spanish name. I don't remember what
Las Herdes Tierras en Pan, which translates to Land Without Bread.
Thank you. Yeah. Which
and Las Herdes is the name of the like mountain range that it takes place in.
Do you want to talk about that one since you did just watch it?
Yeah, I really liked it a lot. It was very interesting. It's what year was that from? It's an earlier, like 1933, which I think is the first year of the Spanish Civil War, like right before the Spanish Civil War started. But yeah, so this is one of the few films actually that he made in Spain, and it's. It seems like a documentary, but it's not really. So it's been called like the first mockumentary. But really, it's like part documentary, but also part scripted. Some of the stuff is staged. Like there's this shot of a goat falling off a mountain that I was like, how'd they get that shot? Turns out they just threw a goat off a mountain so they could get the shot, which is like not great, but whatever. It was 1933. Anyway.
And they made their point.
And they made their point. It's basically about the society of people living in this extremely remote area of Spain, extremely impoverished. And the whole point of it is that like people don't have to live like this if the government like just gave them services and like made a real road and stuff. Like people could be living in much better circumstances. But then it also has kind of like a uncomfortable kind of ethnographic feel to it where it's like, oh God, look at these people, look how they're living. So it's an interesting kind of blend of a lot of things that is really a precursor to a lot of pseudo documentary work that would come much later.
And it pissed people off.
How else to describe it? Yeah. And I can see why.
It was banned. Like after its premiere, like they were not allowed to show it in Spain anymore.
Yes, because a lot of the surrealists identified as communists, and Buñuel, I don't think ever like officially, you know, came down on one side or the other of that. But the film itself, like many of his films, is very critical of the status quo and of the economic realities of what actually was going on in Spain that would lead to the Spanish Civil War and get worse because of that. So he actually had been like exiled from Spain, I think, after Franco came into power because of his extremely subversive work. Doesn't sit well with the authoritarians in general. Yeah, I don't know. What else could I say about that?
No, that was great. That was perfect.
Yeah.
Is that it? Was that all the things we watched? No, you watched the one scene from The Phantom of Liberty.
Right. And that it's another, you know, fancy pants dinner party, except that it's not a dinner party because everyone gets seated at a table that, instead of chairs, has toilets, and everyone takes off their pants and is doing their business and talking, and then somebody mentions how hungry they are, and they're like, oh, that's so shameful. How dare you talk about that at this table? And so then people
it's
actually
a kid,
have...
I think. They, like, scold the kid for, like...
Right. Right. And then we see one of the adults get up and go to a private tiny room where he then eats a meal by himself. So he's taken the act of eating and going to the bathroom and kind of switched those two things, where this one thing is in real life is very shameful. He's kind of turned that on its head, and I loved it. I laughed so hard. What a brilliant, brilliant set piece that is.
It's pretty perfect. That whole movie is like, we talked about the priest thing before, how it's kind of just like veered off into that direction. Like that's that entire movie is like, mm-hmm. you're like, oh, now we're with these people. Like it's a little bit like Slacker. Have you seen Slacker? Mm. Where
I don't think so. Have I? Wait, the Richard Linklater one?
Yeah. It kind of just like you start with one person and then all of a sudden you're in a scene with new people. And it kind of flows there, but it doesn't follow mm-hmm. any one person or group of people. You're just like booping from person to person. That's kind of...
Wait, what is that movie called?
Slacker? No, The Phantom of Liberty.
No. Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's kind of how The Phantom of Liberty is structured. Like, I've seen it multiple times, and it's like watching The Discreet Charm, but worse, where, like, I could tell you some things that happen in it, but, like, every time I watch it, it's like, oh, yeah, that's from this movie. Oh, yeah. It's, like, it's new every time.
I'm just reading his Wikipedia article now. It's very long.
I'm trying to find Simon of the Desert so you can watch it.
What's that one about?
That's the one where the religious dude is like standing atop the thing. He's on like a hunger strike. Everyone's gathering around him. And then this woman shows up and basically starts torturing him to try to get him to stop. And it turns out she's the devil.
Oh, no.
I want to watch all of these movies again now. Like, I wish I could go back to that class now and watch them all again.
Yeah. I mean, that's really...
And hear
true
my like
of I can, all of the classes.
Yeah, but this one in particular, like, so I took four classes. I mean, I would go back and take them all again, definitely. But like this one, I think was particularly good. Like, it was a big class, so it had like I had a professor, and then we had like smaller groups where we had like a TA where we would do like discussions. And the TA actually had been someone who worked with Richard Linklater, so he talked about that a bunch, and like was from Austin, and And I really liked both of them in a way that I'm not sure I liked any of my other teachers that I dealt with there.
Yeah. I just feel like I just being older and just like having so much more of a sense of the world.
It's so much easier to like, put all this in context now, and it's so much
more
interesting.
And just like, you know, like the especially like the work of the existentialists and like everything that was going on at this time. Yeah, it's just like when you're 19, like
you can't know.
You have no frame of reference for any of that stuff.
Like,
it's like we're all gonna die. What?
Yeah, like well, like I feel like if I went back now, like I might have something to say about the meat besides like, it's just meat. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
But my brain like just didn't have enough in it to even. Like, think about it that way then.
Yeah. Or even, like, my first year of art school, I took an elective called Fibers and Mixed Media, which was a fiber arts class, and I had never heard of fiber art before, and at the time was just like, what do we do? What is this? What's happening? What are we doing? And only, like, in the last few years have I been like, fiber art is amazing.
What is
like,
fiber
I finally
art?
Get it. It's anything, it's really an umbrella term, so, like, anything that encompasses fibers? So, like, textile-based stuff, crocheting, knitting, weaving.
Got it, okay.
Yeah, assemblage of fabrics or even rope kind of stuff, you know, anything that's fibrous. Like our midterm was weaving a tapestry and our final project was creating a costume, a full costume out of only newspaper and packing tape.
That sounds like a Project Runway challenge.
It was very much a Project Runway challenge, yes, and it was very challenging.
Also sounds like the circus sometimes.
Yeah, but like I would give anything to go back and be able to take that class now.
Yeah.
Because I just could do I feel like so much more with it. Or even, so like that existentialist Paris class that I took was, I had these two courses that semester. They were back to back in the same room with the same professor who I hated. And the other one was this class called Texts and Contexts, which was like a category of courses offered at my school. And the one that I wound up in was on the transcendentalists, which I really just had no patience for at the time. It was like, this is so dumb. Who cares? Blades of grass, whatever, you know? But like, I still think Walt Whitman had a brain tumor, but I find his work a lot more interesting.
Why do you
now.
Think he had a brain tumor?
Because late in his life, he all of a sudden had this like spiritual awakening, this transcendental awakening that like everything was incredible, and just like the his writing and like descriptions of him at the time and his behavior is to me very consistent with somebody who has a brain tumor, like okay. in a certain spot that will like change your outlook on things, make everything amazing. It's, you know, like, that doesn't just happen to people. People don't all of a sudden be like, oh my god, you guys, Blades of Grass.
They do though, like, because I just read, oh my god, who's the guy who wrote The Power of Now?
I don't know.
I don't remember his name. But that is, I mean, he was like horribly miserable. And then he woke up one day and was like a completely different person. Maybe he had a brain tumor also.
Yeah, I mean, that doesn't, oh, Eckhart Tolle?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't think that just happens.
I do. I don't think it happens to most people, but I do think yeah. it does can happen.
I mean, I would love for that to happen. Can I wake up tomorrow and have everything be amazing, please? Because everything is pretty terrible.
Yeah,
right now.
Well, that's why I read his book, which I didn't yeah. finish reading.
Why didn't you finish it?
Because I'm bad at reading.
Mm, yeah, same.
And, well, I take out books from the library, like, digitally, and you can't keep them for very long. So, like, I'm a person who will, like, start six books and read, like, a page of each one, like, so slowly, like, over a very long time. So, like, library books that I only get to keep for 6 days don't really work well for that.
Yeah, that makes sense. I went back and I have this big Dolly book because I was very into surrealism in, like, high school. Just everything seemed nonsensical to me, and so I found surrealism very kind of comforting. So it was interesting to pull that out and like look at his work and read more about him as a person and an artist, which I never used to like read the words in my art books. I've only very recently started reading the words instead of just looking at the pictures, and so that was interesting to revisit as well, and see, like, I his work around the Spanish Civil War, I think, is so interesting, and, like, doesn't, like, everyone just knows the persistence of memory, and that's not it, but, like, that's the one that people know, and like there's so much more to his work that's so much more interesting than a bunch of melting clocks, you know?
Yeah. No, you go first.
Oh, there was a print of The Persistence of Memory in my elementary school art classroom, and I just remember staring at it like every day, and my brain was just trying to make sense of the shapes, like, what is that? Like, I couldn't even recognize that they were clocks. I was just like, what's happening in this picture? And I wonder how much of that like has shaped my brain landscape. Yeah.
My favorite Dali thing that I've ever seen, I have not looked at many art things at all in general. I feel like that's one of the things that I might be lying to myself about, is like, one day I'll be smart about this, because it is beautiful and interesting and that's cool, but like, whatever, my brain, I can only do so much.
Yeah, we're all doing the best we can.
But I saw an exhibit one time of his stuff, and he made this pin that his lips and the teeth are pearls, and it's so cool and awesome, and I want it.
I'm Googling it right now.
I think it's a pin. It might just be lips.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I've seen this.
I love it.
I think it's like a brooch.
Yeah.
He also made a couch that's lips, and it was
Ooh.
based on the lips of Mae West, who was an old-timey actress.
Cool.
Yeah. I recently watched this short film called The Dali and the Cooper that I forget who played Salvador Dali, but Noel Fielding plays Alice Cooper, and it's
Yes.
about this time, and he's a great Alice Cooper, but his American accent is not great. But this one time, Alice Cooper and Dali like hung out a bunch, and Dali had Alice Cooper like stand there and like photographed him in this like 360 degree thing and created one of the world's first holograms of Alice Cooper wearing a tiara.
Oh, interesting.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a interesting short film about it on Showtime, I think you can watch it. Like if you have streaming Showtime.
This was the first time. Ooh, there's a video of it, of the hologram.
Oh, here is, I'm gonna send you a portrait painted by Dalí of Louise Buñuel when they were young,
Aw, let's see.
from 1929, I guess.
Oh yeah, oh, I like it. Okay, so like watching, so I watched A Discreet Charm a few weeks ago, like we said, but I watched Un Chien Andalou today, and it was the first time that I really got us, or to me, it felt like watching surrealist film felt like people trying to outwardly represent a bunch of anxieties from their insides, which I never really saw it, or like maybe I saw that as a part of it, but like I don't
Yeah,
know.
this is one long stress dream.
That's yeah, right? And I mean
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
what everything David Lynch makes is also.
Yeah.
And all the things that show up, I feel like, I mean, again, like not that I know so much about surrealist work, but in the works that I've seen, like the themes that show up, like are such common things that we all hold like so deep inside of us and have like great anxiety about. Like Buñuel in particular, in addition to like, the church and, the higher classes. Was super obsessed with like sexual fetishes.
And Dali was also very fucked up on sex stuff.
Yeah.
He was like terrified of sex for a long time, and it was like a whole thing for him. Like, and is so intrinsic in all of his work.
Yeah, and so, but like yeah, yes, like those are all of the things that all of us deep down are the most anxious about, you know?
And that's why I kind of preface this conversation by talking about like the origins of surrealism and that it like, grew out of this time where nothing made sense and everything was so horrifying. I mean, like just daily life must have been like a waking nightmare. And that film in particular is exactly that, even though it was made later. But
I also like in my brain can't help but compare Buñuel and Lynch, and like I think because there's a lot of really similar.
Well, that's a
Well,
lineage,
yeah,
like
totally.
David Lynch is clearly like a direct descendant of Buñuel's work
Yeah,
and
but
others, but like you definitely can see the influence there.
like for me watching Buñuel's work, like I said earlier, like it's funny, and like.
And the thing, because I did not get David Lynch for a long time, and I was like, I don't like it. It freaks me out. It just makes me feel uncomfortable and upset, and I don't like it, which is exactly what it's supposed to do. But what I didn't realize is how funny
It's
his work
also
really is.
funny, but
Yeah,
it's like
it's actually hilarious,
funny
but.
with a with like glazed in horror though.
I don't know. I don't know if it's funny glazed in horror or horror glazed in
Oh yeah, I
funny.
don't know which one it is. I
Yeah,
think it depends
the
what you're
ratio
I think it
works
depends
out,
what
yeah.
you're looking at and what scene you're watching too.
So
But
true. Yeah.
it's so easy to put on either one of those lenses. And if you work hard enough, you can turn it into both of those things more easily. Buñuel's work, you can't turn into horror.
Oh, I think it's very straight horror to me. Like, I mean, Un Chien Dans Le Loup is clearly a horror movie.
Yeah, but not in the same way. Like, not in the same way that Lynch does horror. Like,
no, I mean, obviously it's different, but it's there. It's definitely there. I think even The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie has so many horror elements to it. Mm-hmm. And just that feeling of unsettledness and not knowing what's going to happen next. And like, is everyone okay? Are we going to be okay? Like that kind of feeling throughout the entire film.
I feel like in his film, well, at least in this film in particular, I don't care enough about the people to be, you know, like, I don't care if they get murdered, you know, like.
Yeah, and you're not really supposed to either.
No.
Whereas, I guess, in, like, David Lynch's characters are so compelling that, like, you do care.
There's always at least one that you actually care about.
Yeah. Oh, I just remembered. What did I watch yesterday? Oh, I rewatched, and this is highly relevant because it also has a lot of, like, dream nightmare elements to it. The Netflix adaptation of The Haunting of Hill House. It's like a 10-episode series that they did. It's so good. So, so, so good. Definitely my favorite adaptation of the book. But in it, Russ Tamblyn, who plays the psychiatrist in Twin Peaks, plays a psychiatrist on this show. And I was like, all right, the first time I saw this, I had not seen Twin Peaks. And now I've seen Twin Peaks. And I'm like, oh, look at this.
That's
little
funny.
Winky wink.
I like it.
Yeah. Yeah. He's an even worse psychiatrist in this show.
Interesting.
If you can imagine.
Interesting. He's pretty bad in Twin Peaks.
He's pretty bad. Yeah. But that actually, that series is so good and interesting. And there's one of the main characters deals with sleep paralysis, which is a real thing that happens to some people, often in the context also of narcolepsy, but not necessarily. Which basically, like, when you first wake up, your brain can make these chemicals that kind of paralyze you while you're asleep, so you don't act out your dreams. And in some people, their brain wakes up before that chemical wears off, so their brain is awake and they're able to open their eyes, but they can't move their body. And in that state, a lot of times people have like really horrifying hallucinations. And in the show, it deals with ghosts and etc. And so this character is seeing ghosts while experiencing sleep paralysis, and somebody explains it as like your dreams spilling over into reality. And I just find that concept of like dreams spilling into wakefulness really an interesting concept that is kind of directly related to what we're talking
about
here. That's
what surrealism is.
Yeah, not maybe not spilling, more of a big rush of water, horrifying water into your face.
Okay, I think we did it.
We did do it.
Good job.
Next time, we're going to be talking a little bit more about surrealism. We're going to be talking about Frida Kahlo, who is very pivotal, very important influence on me as an artist, and also now as a disabled person. I find her to be an incredibly powerful figure, and I can't wait to talk about her. And we're going to watch that movie that Selma Hayek made and talk about that next time.
Kara, do you want anyone to find you?
No.
Okay, cool. You can find me on Instagram at JordoPC. You can find us on Instagram at WistfulPod. Not that we ever post anything on it anymore, do we?
No.
But it's there.
No, sorry. It is there. We also have a Twitter account that we don't really use. And a Facebook
page. I
can't
tell you the last time I even opened Twitter for anything.
Oh, God bless. I wish I could say the same.
All right. We will talk to you next time. Bye.